Well, before we get into Genesis 16 this morning, excuse me, I want to apologize if you listened to the podcast, not the CDs, but the podcast from last week. The audio is not very good. There's a little setting on top of this MP3 player, and I had adjusted it for, because I was using this for another purpose, and I forgot to adjust it back. And so it just came out, sounded like we're in an echo chamber. It sounded like you're a mile away from me. So I've reset it, so hopefully this week it'll sound normal. And also, before we get into our chapter, I want to share a passage of Scripture with you. I'm not going to put it on the screen because it's part of last week's teaching, actually. But it's one I want us to keep in mind. It's Galatians chapter 3, verses 6 through 9. You can write down the reference right now and read it later if you wish. But last week we talked about the blood covenant that God established with Abraham. God did not establish it. Abraham did not establish it. God initiated this covenant. And the question is, how do we access this? What does this have to do with us? I mean, good for Abraham and his children, but what if I'm a Gentile? Listen to what Paul says. Galatians 3, verses 6 to 9. It says, "Even so, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Therefore, be sure that it is those who are of faith." Are you of faith? Do you believe God? What he says? "Those who are of faith, who are sons of Abraham." When a Gentile converts to Judaism, that Gentile comes to Judaism without a Hebrew name. Normally, in Judaism, you've got your Greek name, your Gentile name, but you also have a Hebrew name that you get when you're circumcised or when you're a child. And so when you're called up to the Torah, instead of calling up Quentin, we would call up, it might be Yahashua ben Mordecai or whatever. It's Hebrew name. So-and-so, son of so-and-so. Well, when a Gentile converts to Judaism, he doesn't have a Jewish father. So they give him a Hebrew name, but the Hebrew name is always, always, always Ben Avraham. So-and-so, son of Abraham. Why do they call him son of Abraham? Because Abraham was the first one of the Gentiles to turn and give his life completely to God and walk in his ways. And as a Gentile, if you convert to Judaism, they see you as doing the same thing. And that's what Paul's referring to here in Galatians. Let me continue. So, therefore be sure that it is those who are of faith who are sons of Abraham. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith. Remember, Abraham was a Gentile who was justified by faith. Preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, quote, "All the nations shall be blessed in you," unquote. So then, those who are of faith are blessed with Abraham, the believer. Let's get a microphone to Janet so she can ask a question. And if you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions and share comments. So, yes, Janet.
Is that why it says that when you go to heaven, you will have a new name?
That's part of it. That is part of it. If we ever get into Revelation, we'll address that. But don't hold your breath, okay? All right, Genesis chapter 16. Last week was this wonderful, wonderful, incredible chapter about God establishing this blood covenant with Abraham. And then once in a while in the scriptures, you have chapters I just call train wrecks. This is one of them. If God didn't want us seeing all the dirty laundry of the forefathers and so on, he would have left chapter 16 out, just gone right on to 17, which is a wonderful chapter. But if we come to chapter 16, it's only 15 verses long, but there's a lot going on in this chapter, and it's not pretty. So let's just dive right in and see what we can make of this chapter. I sent out an email during the week and asked you a few questions about this chapter, and so if you have some input, please be sure to raise your hand and share input as we go through. So let's take a look at the first couple of verses. Genesis 16, starting with verse 1. "Now Sarai," Abram, or Avram is how it's truly pronounced, "Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar or Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "See, now Adonai has restrained me from bearing." In other words, it's God's fault. And God takes full credit for Sarai not bearing. I mean, he could have made it easy for her to bear or not easy to bear. And let me put a little parenthesis in here. As we look at the lives of Abraham and Sarah, recall, you have to remember this all through these studies that we do, that God calls himself the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Or sometimes the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He just puts them all together. Over and over and over and over and over in the scriptures, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You have to take these three together. And though we haven't gotten to Isaac and Jacob yet, if you keep trying to conjure up what you know of Isaac and Jacob, keep conjuring that up and their wives and make comparisons. Because not only did Sarai have difficulty bearing, their son's wife, Rebecca, had difficulty bearing. And then that son, Jacob's wife, his son, their son, Jacob, his wife, his beloved Rachel, had difficulty bearing. You're going to find similarities. And these similarities are pretty stark and amazing. But alongside the similarities, you'll see exact opposites. One of the things, all three wives, Sarah, and then her daughter-in-law Rebecca, her daughter-in-law Rachel, they all tried to do some substituting. Here, Sarah wants Hagar to substitute for her and have a child. Rebecca, what did she substitute? Now, she had twins, Jacob and Esau. Remember what she did? She substituted Jacob for Esau. Put on your brother's clothes. Put some goat hair on your neck and your hands because he's hairy and he smells. Okay, and put his clothes on, and your father who's blind comes. He's not going to recognize your voice, but he'll touch you and smell you and feel your neck, and then you'll get the blessing instead of Esau. And then her daughter-in-law, Rachel, did some substituting. Okay, we'll let you figure that one out. But you're going to find similarities, and it's pretty amazing. Also, Sarah died before her time. She did not get to see her grandchildren. Rebecca died before her time. She did not get to see her grandchildren. Rachel died before her time. She did not get to see her grandchildren. So, watch these things. But even more importantly, look at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God establishes his covenant with all of them and with all of their children. But, okay, parenthesis over. We'll get back to work. And Sarai said to Abram, "See now, Adonai has restrained me from bearing. Consort now with my maidservant. Perhaps I will be built up through her." Is that a good motive? I will be built up? Why didn't you just say, perhaps I'll have children through her? Perhaps she'll have a child, we'll just adopt that child as our own. This is something that was done in ancient times. And then Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. So, several questions here. First of all, let's look at the name Hagar. The word is really made up of two. In Hebrew, when you attach the letter he to the front of a word, it means the. Okay? And then the second part of her name is ger. And what's a ger? A sojourner, a wanderer, an alien, a stranger. So it means, we'll put sojourner, someone who's wandering around. Another example of this word is, remember, in Exodus 2:22, Moses, he's left Egypt where his people are. He's gone to Midian, and he marries a Midianite girl named Zipporah. She bears a child. It says, then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom. For he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. Now you look at Gershom. There is the word ger, again at the front, right? And then sham means there. Ger sham, a sojourner there. A stranger there in a strange land. You get the idea? So, I'll go ahead and write this down for you. A sojourner there. All right. So, when we read about Hagar, Hagar you can think of as a person without roots. A person without roots. And she started off in Egypt. She's Egyptian. And now she's in Canaan. And then she runs off the wilderness. Then they bring her back. And then she gets kicked out and goes back to the wilderness. Doesn't go back to Egypt. She's a wanderer. Everything about Hagar is the sojourner, the wanderer. And but we have to ask a question here. Why did Sarah do this? It's like she felt like God had been complacent. It's like, Abram, God made this incredible blood covenant with you just in the last chapter. And we're still waiting. Years have passed, still no children. He says, your children be like the dust of the earth, there'll be so many. Your children be like the stars of the heaven, so many. I mean, I'd be happy with just one. Where are they? And she got impatient. And so she decided she would fulfill God's promise. This is always a dangerous, dangerous thing to do. I've done it. I bet all of you have done it. We get tired of waiting on God. We think God's complacent. God's out to lunch. He's not paying attention. He just doesn't love us. And so we set out to kind of fulfill our own desires or fulfill his own promises. Or we pray for something. God doesn't answer the time frame that we've established. And so we go to answer our own prayer. And it's always a disaster. It always produces an Ishmael. It always produces an Ishmael. And we all have brought Ishmaels into the world. And we just need to be very careful. And that's why this chapter is kind of a train wreck. But if we sort through the rubble, we can learn some lessons and maybe avoid train wrecks in our own life. And another question is, I mentioned that Rebecca had difficulty bearing children, but what did Rebecca do? She prayed. And then Jacob's wife, Rachel, she had difficulty bearing children. What did she do? She prays. Why doesn't Sarah pray? Now, I'm sure she probably had, but just doesn't mention that she had. But there's no mention that she did. Why didn't she pray? Sarah was a woman of action, more than a woman of prayer, it would seem. And so she took action. Action she's going to be very sorry she took, and I think Abram is too. And so we move on, and it says that in verse 3, so Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maidservant, after 10 years of Abram's dwelling in the land of Canaan. Now, why is the 10 years important? Well, in ancient times, this isn't in the Bible, but there's ancient tradition, and not just in Jewish culture, but in other Middle Eastern cultures, that if a man marries a woman and after 10 years she doesn't produce a child, then he's free to divorce her. He can just divorce her, kick her to the curb. Now, Abram didn't do that. We don't know how long he was married to her before they came to Canaan, but he must have thought, now that we're in Canaan, she'll have that child. And 10 years passed, she just still didn't have one. But he never wanted to take another wife. His love for Sarah was so strong that he only had the one wife. He didn't divorce her. He could have taken a second. Polygamy, I mean, it was practiced all the time back then. But he never took a second wife. He just loved her, just wanted her. So after 10 years in the land, she still hasn't produced. And she doesn't say, divorce me, but she says, well, at least take another wife, take another woman and have a child. We'll adopt that child as our own. And it says, and gave her to Abram, her husband, to him as a wife. Verse 4, he consorted with Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her eyes. So the handmaiden, who's the handservant to Sarah, now that she's conceived, she's now kind of elevated herself in her own mind, now looking down at Sarah's wife, or at Abram's wife, Sarah. Verse 5. So Sarai said to Abram, this Hamas, this outrage, this violence, that's the word Hamas. Back in Genesis 6, it says the whole world was filled with Hamas. With violence, so God brought the flood. That's the same word used here. This outrage, she was just exploding. This outrage against me is due to you. It's your fault, Abram. It was I who gave my maidservant into your bosom, and now that she sees that she is conceived, I became lower than her eyes. Let Adonai judge between me and you. Abram said to Sarah, wait a big minute. This was your idea, not mine. Don't put this on me, woman. Oh, wait, I read that wrong. He said, behold, your maidservant. You didn't notice he doesn't call her his wife, though Sarah had called Hagar his wife. He once again puts Hagar back to what she was, says, your maidservant is in your hand. Do to her as you see fit. And Sarah dealt harshly with her, so she ran away. So here's the big $64 question. Why didn't Abraham defend himself against Sarah's attack? I mean, when she first offered Hagar, he could have just said no. He could have said no, but Sarah wanted Hagar to go to him. She wanted Hagar to bear a child. And so Abram said, okay. But why didn't he defend himself? I think you're getting warm. There are a couple reasons here, by the way. Where's our microphone runner? Okay, I see Philip's hand up right here. Dale, a couple rows in front of you. Philip.
I wasn't necessarily going to make a huge statement, but to me it just seems like maybe perhaps he accepted some responsibility or complicitness.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Here's the question. How did Hagar come to be Sarah's handmaid?
Egypt.
All right, Egypt. Let's go back and review the history. Back in Genesis 12, verses 11 and 12, remember, God tells Abraham, leave your land, your people, and go to the Canaan. All right, go to the land, I'll show you. He comes to Canaan. And what happens when he gets to Canaan? Right away, there's a famine. It's like, Lord, you told us to come here, and there's no food. And so, God does not tell Abram to go to Egypt. Abram just decides to go to Egypt. He decided maybe God was a little complacent, and then Abram had to take things into his own hands. Like Sarah thought God was complacent, and she had to take things into her own hands. She's modeling Abram's behavior. So anyways, it says in Genesis 12, 11 and 12, and it came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, see now, I know that you are a beautiful woman, and it will come about when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife. They will kill me, but they will let you live. So he kind of thought, God, you brought us this land. Where's the food? Did he pray? It doesn't say he did. Was he patient? No, obviously not. Did he seek God's counsel? Apparently not. He decided, let's go to Egypt. There's food there. So Sarai follows the same behavior. She doesn't pray. She doesn't seek counsel. She's not patient. She doesn't wait. She acts. And what happens? Well, it's a very embarrassing situation. Pharaoh realizes that, wait a minute, this is not his sister. This is his wife. So you fast forward on down to verse 16. And Pharaoh kicks them out of Egypt, says, therefore Pharaoh treated Abraham well for her sake and gave him sheep and oxen, donkeys and male and female servants, and female donkeys and camels, and then later kicks him out. So when Abram comes back to Canaan, he's got Hagar along with him. You see, Hagar being part of the family is Abram's fault, not Sarah's. So he was complicit in this whole thing. He'd modeled some faithless behavior to his wife, and she reflected it back. And this leads us to our second thing. Why didn't he argue with her? Because Abram knew a very important principle. It's one I've reiterated here over and over and over and over again. Men, your wife is a mirror of you. Now, some mirrors are better reflectors than others. And some mirrors can be just completely broken. But before you decide your wife is a broken mirror, won't you take a quick look, take a good hard look, and look at the dissatisfaction and the character flaws you see in your wife, and then humbly ask yourself before God, are those really my character flaws I'm looking at? And you see, if you look in the mirror and you don't like what you see, it's really not the mirror's fault. And you change what you see in the mirror, not by changing the mirror, by changing yourself. It's amazing how much better of a wife Robin has become as I have worked on myself. It's amazing. When I used to work on her, it didn't do much good. When it worked on me, all of a sudden she changes. She's not aware of it. She's not even aware of it. But it's amazing. The more I work on me, the happier my wife is, the happier I am. Happy wife, happy life. And but it took me the longest time to realize, no, hello, McFly, you know, God's doing this on my head. That's a mirror. She's a mirror of you. She's your instrument panel. She's telling you and giving you feedback how you're doing. And so, men, you have to realize this. Don't criticize your wife. Just don't do it. It will be like, it'll feel like death to her. She's not a man. She's a woman. She's a completely different species. She's not a man. You don't talk to your wife like you talk to a man. She's not a man. She doesn't respond like a man. Doesn't think like a man. The internal workings of her brain are completely different. It's a human body with an alien brain put in it. And thank God it is. She's supposed to be different. And but if you can learn the principle, don't criticize your wife. Don't correct and criticize her. Treat her with great delicacy. Treat her with great honor. And when you see unhappiness and stress in your wife, then look for the problem inside of you. And when you fix that, all of a sudden the stress in your wife's life just kind of evaporates. It's just gone. God said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and glue to his wife. Be glued to her. That's what the word is. And they're glued together. She's not glued to you, guys. You're glued to her. It's her, not her job to glue to you. It's your job to attach to her. And she'll always just reflect back your character. She'll reflect back. So decide what's the thing that most frustrates me about my wife. Find that spiritual counterpart in you. And it's there. If you need help, I'll talk to you. I'll point it out. And work on that. And you'll be amazed how much your wife improves. You really will. Yes, Dale.
I was just thinking about how you're talking about the length of time for these children to come along in all three of these women's lives.
Yes.
It reminds me of a parable in the Brit Hadashah where Jesus is talking about a tree that doesn't bring forth fruit. And the tree's already mature, but then he says to fertilize it and do this and that. Now, the tree already has sun, the tree has water, it's planted in the ground. It's sitting there mature, but it doesn't bring forth fruit.
Yeah.
Can you comment on why it takes more years to bring forth the fruit instead of just coming to maturity and picking it up?
Well, that's a great question. I'll just share with you what I've been in two conversations I can remember over the last week about this very thing. And it's like this. You want fast fruit, plant weeds. If you want enduring fruit, plant olive trees. And I remember a saying I heard back when I was just a kid. Someone said, you don't plant olive trees for yourself or your children. You plant them for your grandchildren. Because if you plant an olive tree, you're not going to see any fruit. And your children won't see any fruit. Your grandchildren will. Olive trees are amazing. And olive trees are the epitome of a fruitful tree in the scriptures. And these things last for thousands of years. If you go to Jerusalem, go to the Gethsemane, there are olive trees there that were alive and mature when Yeshua was there praying in the garden. And if you cut an olive tree down, in fact, every few centuries, 200-300 years, this is where we get all of our olive wood, by the way. And you can buy olive wood, you know, to do woodworking. Every 200 or 300 years, I'll take an olive tree, just cut it off. And what happens, new shoots come out of the stump. You know, you read how out of the stump of Jesse a shoot has come, all right? And that's healthy for the tree, just to cut it down. Because they'll just, new shoots come, and they'll watch, and the strongest shoot, they'll trim back all the others and let that one grow up, and it'll be bearing fruit before long. And olive trees are just amazing, incredible. They're not pretty, but they're amazing, amazing trees. And then when you think of olives, they serve three purposes. I think we talked about this a few months ago. We read the blessing the passage every Shabbat morning, the liturgy, where God talks about if we keep his commandments, so you know he'll bring the rains, and says you'll gather in your wheat and your grain, your new wine, and your fine oil. Think about those three: grain, wine, oil. Grain is good for one thing, food. Wine is good for two things, food and medicine. It's got healing properties to it. Oil is good for three things, food, healing, and fuel for light. See, this keeps getting better and better and better. Olive trees, that's where you get your olive oil. And it's good for so many things. And what a wonderful fruit it is. It's amazing. So anyways, you're getting me off on a whole different tangent here, but thank you for the question. And I see Adam's hand up, so let's get the microphone over to Adam.
Just, I guess, running with that tangent for half a second.
Sure.
As you were talking, it resonated with me with the olive tree, because I'm in a house now that I don't plan on being there for long, and I planted a tree, but I was really hesitant to plant it because I'm like, who knows if the next person will enjoy it?
Yeah.
And I know we have several people here that, you know, starting farms or stuff, and there's a real hesitancy with planting fruit trees, because you're like, maybe I'll only enjoy them in 5 years. And I really think that's our culture, is it's, yeah. You know, we're hesitant to invest in, well, I can't say eternal treasure, you know, but long-term temporary treasure on earth, because we don't know who's going to collect. And I think I look at the, you know, congregationally, how sometimes we invest in ourselves, or we serve in the congregation. Sometimes when I study, it may not bear fruit immediately, but I know I'm studying to store up knowledge that maybe 20 years down the road will benefit somebody.
Yeah, that's great.
When we serve in the church, when we contribute here, it's not just what can I get back from it right now, but it's knowing I'm trying to create a strong congregation for those kids under the hoopla.
That's right. Good point. Well, you remind me, too, that you know, the Torah talks about not gleaning the corners of your field, leave something for others. Well, the people who live in Jerusalem and many places in Israel, they don't have farms. But what they all do is they'll plant a fruit tree right in the front yard, close to the sidewalk, close to the road. And they do that so anybody who comes by, take some fruit. You're welcome to it. It's for you. And that's pretty amazing thing. So they plant fruit trees in their front yards for passersby just to take the fruit. So if you move, don't worry about it. Let the next people enjoy it or do what they will with it. Of course, my father-in-law dug up our trees and brought them over to our new house and planted them there. But you can talk to Jim later if you want. Maybe we'll pull that for you. So in the box here on the screen, I put this. Hagar became Sarah's handmaid due to Abraham's fear. Remember? He was afraid they would starve. They went to Egypt. He's afraid to be killed because they would take Sarah, his wife. Then Hagar became Abraham's concubine due to Sarah's doubt. The result, Ishmael. When we take actions because of fear and of faithlessness, Ishmael is born. And we're going to look at the qualities, or I should say the characteristics. He had a few qualities. But we'll look at the characteristics of Ishmael in just a moment. But they're not pretty. They populate like weeds. They have far-reaching effects, but they're not pretty. And Ishmael became the enemy of Abraham's legitimate children. So be careful of the things you produce in your life that become your enemies later on. And when you act out of fear and doubt, you're producing things that will be your enemy. They'll be destructive in your life. But they will also be instructive in your life, because that's God's purpose for all of our enemies. Okay? We can't lose with the God we have. He'll use everything for our good. Now, it says there in verse 6 that she dealt harshly with Hagar. But Abram said to Sarai, behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. So Sarai dealt harshly with her. This is the exact same word that's used later on in Exodus chapter 1. And it says, so they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. In verse 12, but the more they afflicted, they dealt harshly with them. It's the same word. And back in Genesis 15, last week's chapter, when God makes the blood covenant, he tells Abram that his children are going to be afflicted. In verse 13, it says, and God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed. It's the same word, 400 years. This word that we're looking at is the word anah. That's it. Ayin, nun, hey, anah. But it has more meanings than just to be oppressed, to afflict, to deal harshly. It's a pretty amazing word. Only Hebrew has words like anah in it. We see this word coming up again in our chapter, in verse 9. Where the angel appears to Hagar, and it says, the angel of Adonai said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself to her authority. Same word, anah. Well, think about that. Just stop there for a second. This word has two meanings so far. Affliction, to be dealt with harshly. It's also the word for submit. Because to submit never feels fun. It always seems like a bad idea. But to submit to someone, a bad boss, a bad husband, a bad whatever it is, a bad situation, to submit means you're going to embrace the unpleasantness that you're going to submit to. Because the harshness that comes our lives requires us sometimes to stay in the dentist chair while he drills into our teeth. We have to submit to the pain. Or else no good is done. Let's go on a little bit further. It's used again in verse 11. The angel of Adonai said to her, further, behold, you are with child. You shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because Adonai has given heed to your anah, to your affliction. God hears the anah in our lives. He gives heed to it. And I think sometimes you don't feel like our prayers are answered. God's paying attention. And maybe it's because we're not submitting to the pain he has ordained for us. But when we do submit to the pain he has ordained, he heeds it. He hears it. And again, in Exodus, he tells Moses, you tell the people there, I've heard their affliction. I've seen it. I know what it is. I know what they're going through. Remember, pain and bad are not the same, and good and pleasant are not the same. We tend to measure good and bad in terms of pleasant or unpleasant. And often there's no connection. Good is good, bad is bad. Sometimes good is unpleasant. Sometimes bad is very pleasant. But we do what's right. We submit to God's commandments. It's not the pain that's bad. The pain is our teacher oftentimes. It's our refiner. Talking about olive trees. The olive can only produce its goodness if it's crushed. And when you look in the holy place, in the tabernacle, you've got a menorah on the left that's fed with olive oil. And on the right, you've got the bread of presence. And right in front of you, you've got the altar of incense. What do all three of these have in common? The olive oil for the menorah had to be crushed. The grain to make the bread had to be crushed. The incense on the altar had to be crushed. And this gives light, this gives life, and that gives fragrance. And it goes over the wall to bring joy to the Lord. Without crushing, there's not much good that comes out of us at all. We have to learn that principle. It's not going to kill you. And if it does, are you going to look back and complain? Are you going to look back from heaven and say, oh, I want to go back? I mean, no. It's all right. What's the worst going to happen? You'll die. I got news for you. You're going to die anyway. So might as well die with purpose, right? And I see Tony's hand up. So let's get a microphone to Tony here.
You know, as we're going over this, God never ordained this type of behavior with the many wives and concubines.
Yeah.
And as we go through the scriptures with David, Solomon, now that was after the law, and they were still doing it. So it was a cultural thing.
Sure.
And I would think for you to have many wives, you'd have to be able to afford them. So it couldn't have been through the whole, all the tribes of Israel. But as we look at it, didn't this create a whole lot of problems for Israel?
Oh, we're going to get to that. Yes, and it's prophesied in this chapter. Yes.
And then I look at the apostles, and there's no mention of their women.
No.
Their spouses, that they had spouses.
Yeah.
And I'm just, it's amazing that God let them, allowed them to create their demise, their issues.
Well, maybe one of the reasons the apostles' wives did not have these issues is because they learned from the mistakes of Sarah and the others in the scriptures. It's like the old saying, learn from other people's mistakes. You don't have time to commit them all yourself. So learn from other people's mistakes. And the wives of the apostles learned. So, all right. I hope we learn from other people's mistakes, or I'm wasting my time up here. All right. So, now let's look at another use of anah. It means, you see, first of all, it means to afflict. It means to submit. But look at this. Numbers 12:3. Now, the man Moses was very anah, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. It means humble. When you submit to affliction, one of the fruits is humility. And there's another fruit when you submit to the pain God ordains. Believe it or not, the word anah means to answer. To answer a question is to anah the question. And Abraham answered in chapter 18, verse 27. There's a use of the word anah there. Same word. I'm not playing games with this word. It's the same word, anah. It means to answer. You want answers to your questions? Then go through what God's ordained for you to go through. A lot of times we want to know things in our head. He says, no, you're going to get the answer in your heart. Then your head can figure it out from there. Well, you've got to go through what you have to go through. And he prompts a response in the depths of our soul. Then finally it filters up in our brain and says, now I get it. That's how it works. We want the information. Because that's our Greek mindset. That's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil going on in our souls. And God says, no. I'm just going to prompt something within you. This is why reading the Word of God, even if you don't understand everything you're reading, there's something spiritual about the Word that speaks to the Spirit in you, whether your understanding is fruitful or not. That's why we just need to read it and build it into our hearts. And then it begins to float up into our brains. But there's another meaning for anah. Psalm 147:7. Sing to Adonai with thanksgiving. It's the word anah again. So here we go. Anah. It means to afflict, submit, and then you get the fruit, humility. You get answers, and you sing. All one word. What an amazing language Hebrew is. That one word has all those five meanings to it. Incredible, isn't it? What we want is we want the singing and the answers. Humility, I'll act normal. I'll act humble if I have to. And these two, no thanks. But that's not the way it works. We took these in the order of appearance in the Torah. And afflict comes before submit, and that comes before humble, and then those come before answers and singing. This is the order of appearance in the Torah. Don't try to change that order. This is the order it happens. So anah, it's important we learn the beauty of this word. But you have to go through the pain first. And you have to submit to it willingly. You know, it's like the living sacrifice. Somebody once said the problem with living sacrifices is they keep crawling off the altar. So you have to go into where the pain is and then submit to it. Stay put. And then we can get humility, which makes us more like God. We were in the prayer service talking about Psalm 113, which describes God as a humble God. Then we get the answers, and then praise pours out of us. And that's the order in which those things occur. And let's get a microphone over to Walt here. Yes, Walt.
As you look at the order of let us submit, humble, there's no guarantee you'll get through the process, is there? I mean,
I think so.
Is there?
Yeah, I think so. Otherwise, the pain was, it was just empty, purposeless. And I think God's pain always has purpose for us. Now, if we'll submit to it, that is, if we submit, this is the big if right here. But I think, yeah. But if we keep trying to dodge the pain, we'll just have a life of pain. That's all we'll have. But if we go through the affliction submission, then I think the rest will definitely follow. The fruit will come.
Okay, so you're saying this is kind of the order. Mm-hmm. And how we respond to it makes a difference in the outcome.
That's the decision takes place right there at step number two. Because that's the one that's not passive. People will afflict us. People will humiliate us. But this is the submit. This is the one where we do something. We actually do something. We submit to it. And then the fruits follow. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I just struggle with that. Because the journey I'm on, I see this conflict in my life almost daily right now.
Sure.
Where do I step in or step aside or submit? I think that was tough.
Well, submit is it's not a matter of just like a slave driver over saying, yes, I'll do it, I'll do it. I think sometimes it means just embrace the life that God's given you. Just embrace it. What is the role God has assigned you in life? Embrace that role, because your role will probably change later on. But don't identify with the role. The role is not you. The role is something you do. And then your role changes. But embrace what God brings along. Grow where you're planted. Be where you are. And we're often wanting to escape. In fact, I see some hands up. Let me share this. Oh, no, we'll go with you. Let's get a microphone over to Ben. Maybe Ben will have a better answer for you, Walt, than I do.
Is it on?
Yes.
So when you're saying submit, you're meaning submitting to God, right?
Well, yes, but we have to realize God is in all the experiences he brings our way.
Right, so if it starts in your heart submitting to God, then it's gonna equal submitting to something or someone that God is saying, submit yourself to this.
Yeah. Well, let me take an example to make sure we're clear. You might be married, you're not, but you hypothetically, a man can be married to a woman he really just doesn't like at all. Oh, God, I love you, I want to serve you, I submit to you, but get this wicked creature out of my life. And then God's saying, I put her there for you. Submit. Or you're a wife, you're married to this rotten man, and the wife says, Lord, I love you, I just want to worship you and serve you, but this rotten man's in my way. And he says, I put him there. Submit. Let him have a work in your life. This rotten boss, Lord, get him out of the way so I can serve you. I put him there. Submit. You understand? No, here's one who doesn't. He says, no, not my boss.
Well, I think the thing that has happened for me, and I think we're saying the same thing.
I just want to make sure we are. Yeah,
well, there's some kind of fear or trouble that's inside of me.
Yeah.
And God has put an opportunity for me to overcome that fear inside by submitting to this situation. Mm-hmm. And as I do that, it brings about a new faith and a power, God's power inside of me, that then makes my choices very clear. Because I can almost hear and receive what he has better after the fear is gone. But without submitting to the troubled thing, by him, you know, I feel like he's directing me to submit. So I don't want to say, oh, I just want to submit to all this badness. I feel like God speaks to our hearts and says, submit to this, and then we get stronger.
Yep. Yeah, I can't argue with that. And right behind you, Patty. Let's get a microphone to Patty. Oh, on the other, there we go. I can only imagine what people are imagining as they listen to this. You know, how, where are all these people spread out here?
I was just thinking about how when Jesus was in the Garden of Gethsemane,
yes,
and he prayed and asked, if it's your will for the cup to... So, kind of like if you pray and ask God, I'm not sure if this is from you, so could you take it out? And if he doesn't, then you...
He submitted to it. Yeah. He prayed three times that it'd be taken away, and God said no. So we went through it. If we can bounce back to the olive tree for a second, it's really interesting. When you process olives, there are two processes. First, there's the olive crush. And in Gethsemane, which shemen is the word for oil, and the Gethsemane was the place where they would take the olives. It was in an olive grove. And they put them in bags. They run this real heavy stone over it one time. And the whole purpose of that stone, some oil is going to come out, but the main purpose is to break the pit of the olive, to deal with the inside of the olive first. And what happened in Gethsemane? Blood comes out of his brow, sweat drops of blood. And God was dealing with the inside of Yeshua. I don't want to, there's no physical suffering going on, but it was in his heart, I don't want to do this, nevertheless, not my will, but your be done. Right? There's this internal wrestling match. Then they take him and they crucify him. And the crucifixion took place where there was a garden and there's an olive press. Now that's where they take the olives where the pit has been crushed. They put it in the press and now they roll the stone over it and over it and over it to squash out all the oil. So that is where you see the physical suffering. Now his body is bleeding, it's all beat up, and he's, you know, nailed, he's pierced, and it's just, it's a, you know, they just are crushing him physically. So there's an internal breaking, then there's this external. And you see this taking place with olives as well. And I think once his heart was dealt with, his will was dealt with, and he had submitted completely in the garden, then I think what happened on the cross, he could do that now. And I know my biggest wrestling matches are always the internal ones. In fact, the pain in my, the physical pain is never as bad as the wrestling match inside. That's the, that's where the fight really goes on. And then after, and I'm not belittling the crucifixion, don't get me wrong, but in my case, the physical pain that I have to go through, it seems like after it's over, that was it. Well, it wasn't so bad. And, but, yeah, anyways, I want to get to something here, then we'll come back to Mary Jo. 1 Corinthians 10:13. I know if you've been through the Navigators 2:7, I keep looking at the people over here. It's like we have the riffraff on this side, and I'm looking at the sheep. I'm sorry. I don't know why I do that. You just need to raise your hands more on this side, and I'll ignore them instead. All right, 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted. And the word tempt and test are the same word. Tested, tempted, beyond what you're able. But with the temptation will provide the way of escape. Horrible translation. Terrible translation. Yet almost every translation has that. Almost all of them do. Also that you may be able to endure it. The word way of escape is the word ekbasin. Ekbasin. It's only used two times in the Bible. One is here, 1 Corinthians 10:13, and the other one's in Hebrews 13:7, which says, remember those who led you, who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the outcome, it should be the word the in there, the outcome of their conduct. Outcome. It doesn't say consider the way they escaped. The outcome. the fruit, the goal, what happened as they went through what they went through. That is the word. He will provide an outcome. He'll provide an end to it, an ending point, a fruit, a goal, and something for finally is like, oh, okay, now I've reached what I was trying to get to. If you keep looking for an escape from testing, you're just going to get into a worse testing. Go through the testing, come out the other side, and experience the outcome of the test. Got it? Okay. Bad translations can lead to some bad decision-making on RBFs. And then Mary Jo, if we can come back to you. You had your hand up earlier, and then we'll get back to the back row here.
Let's see here. I was thinking about affliction and when you got into submission. And you sort of hit it on the head about the olive tree and everything that's mm-hmm. internal.
Yes.
When we have affliction, whether it be bodily mm-hmm. or relational, that can make us very narcissistic, can make us self-absorbed, mm-hmm. Poor me, that kind of deal.
Yeah.
And the changes in our life that we would like to see happen,
mm-hmm.
we're like, oh, why don't they change? Why doesn't, why can't I get rid of this? Blah, blah, blah. Really comes from an internal.
Yeah.
The submission is internal, and it's Christ came for us internally, for our spirits. And I sort of thought about gratitude. Living in gratitude.
Yes. Amen.
Changing. We need to change our thinking. When we have the submission, is really a turning of our thinking around, and that could take years.
Sure.
Because it is something that we have to look at and thank God for. When you did Psalms this morning, mm-hmm. that was. Very much, what are we thankful for?
Yeah.
In the midst of our afflictions,
yeah.
and we all have them in this room,
sure.
we have to look at gratitude.
Absolutely.
And it, from my own personal experience, it took years. It took daily gratitude lists of 2016, using the alphabet, doing A, B, C, D, things like that.
Sure.
Just waking up in the morning, like Janet said, and thinking that I have breath. I have the
yes.
breath of God in me.
Yeah.
But our question is, can I be happy even though everything I want is not present?
Oh, I sure hope so, or else nobody's going to be happy.
That is, that is what comes back to me.
Yeah.
I did have a question there, but you answered it, and then I put my hand up, so I thought, okay, I guess I'm going to get on my soapbox.
Yeah, that's okay. I appreciate your insights. Those are profound.
Thank you,
very good.
Yeah, sure. On it when you talk about the olive tree and,
yeah.
What's inside of me
yeah.
and what needs to be put inside of me.
Yeah. We all want happiness, right? We all want happiness, and God is called the happy God, the Ashrei. Ashrei means happy. Ashrei ha'ish, happy is the man. And he wants us to be happy. Happiness always lies on the other side of pain. And all pain, remember, is what? Birth pain. All pain is birth pain. When you see pain mentioned in the Bible the first time, it's in the context of birth. Birth is a wonderful thing. New life. You have a child. All the things Sarah wants. But there has to be birth pain before the child. And all pain is birth pain. If we embrace it as that, we realize there's an outcome to it. There's a goal to it. Happiness is right on the other side. So quit trying to dodge the pain, numb the pain, avoid the pain, smother the pain. Go through the pain. And there you'll find your happiness. So anyone who says, I deserve to be happy, you know what goes through my mind? Not yet. Anybody who says that needs more pain in their lives. You don't deserve to be happy. But happiness is there once you embrace the pain and go through it and let it give birth. If you think happiness is something you deserve, No, you need to go through some more labor. Not quite there yet. Not quite ready. Just that simple. And I see Tim's hand up, and then we're going to move on and finish the chapter. Tim, do you have a microphone?
Yeah, okay, good. I was when we were in labor.
You mean when your wife was in
labor? When my wife was in labor.
Let's get it straight.
Okay, now you're right. Okay. When Tara was in labor, she was a champ for 23 hours.
Yeah.
She faced the pain. She knew that there was purpose in it.
Yeah.
She saw the end. And was an inspiration.
Yeah.
When we made the decision, because of exhaustion, Jeffrey being not quite lined up right, to proceed with the C-section. It's because we just wanted to meet it. Right?
Yeah.
If we were gonna have a C-section, this was the way we wanted to do it, not because of an emergency or anything. Anyway, so as soon as we made the decision to have a C-section, all of a sudden that pain that she had been facing and conquering all day was now unbearable.
Yeah.
Because there was no purpose in it.
Yeah. That's great.
There was no purpose for that pain because we had decided to meet him by a different road.
Yeah. That's a great illustration.
So, and another thing, another kind of anecdote, that I may have shared this before. I've told a lot of people about it. Sometimes knowing that there is an end is all that's needed to endure anything. I share the example of a woman who years ago swam across the English Channel. And there were points along her journey during which there was a fog that set in. And she couldn't see, 50 feet in front of her. It wasn't that it was too physically demanding, but she had to stop. She couldn't keep going because in her mind she couldn't see that there was a way forward. She couldn't see the end. She couldn't see that there was a way. All she saw was fog. And so her brain just stopped. She couldn't keep going. And then when the fog lifted, she pressed on and did something very physically demanding.
Mm.
Just knowing that there's an end is all that's needed most times to endure the most excruciating and difficult challenge.
That's a great illustration. And thank you for sharing that. Maybe your sharing that was the whole reason why Tara went through 23 hours of labor, because I know your comment is going to reach a lot of people. So thank you for sharing that. It reminded me of in Hebrews where it speaks of Yeshua, who says, who for the joy that was set before him, right? He endured the cross, despising the shame. He could go through it because he was farsighted. His salt was on the other side. And that's what we have to do. Anyways, we've got to finish up the chapter. And so let's just pick it up. We're going to blaze through and finish. Verse 10, and an angel, she runs away. The angel appears to her. Let's see here. So she flees. Verse 7, an angel of Adonai found her by the spring of water in the desert, in the wilderness, at the spring on the road to Shur. And he said, Hagar, maidservant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? He asked two questions. Does she answer the two questions? She only answers one. She said, I'm running away from Sarah, my mistress. She doesn't know where she's going. She only knows she's getting away. This is the case of everyone who tries to escape pain. We know what we're trying to get away from, but where do we go? We're lost. We don't know where we're going. And an angel of Adonai said to her, return to your mistress, submit yourself to her hand. And an angel of Adonai said to her, I will greatly increase your offspring, and they will not be counted for abundance. Now, does this sound similar to something we've heard before? Back in chapter 13, God tells Abram his children will be so numerous that they'll be like the dust of the earth. And then in 15, there'll be so many children be like the stars of heaven. Now, is dust necessary? Yeah, you grow food out of the dirt. It gives life. Are the stars necessary? Yes, they give light to the earth, and they're there to give us the signs and seasons. He tells her, you can have a lot of kids. Are they going to give life? Doesn't say. Are they going to give light? No. Why is she going to have so many children? Because this is going to be a child of Abram. God made a covenant with Abram. I'm going to just multiply your seed like crazy, even if they come through this Egyptian handmaiden. Even if it starts with Ishmael. We're in covenant. And so when you produce, there's going to be a lot of them. Unfortunately, this seed over here, there's going to be a lot. It's not going to bring life and light to the world. It's like this. Joe Schmo lives down at the end of the street and doesn't talk to anybody. He falls into some kind of a sin, gets arrested. They take him to jail, mugshot, bail, the whole thing. Nobody cares. It's Joe Schmo down at the end of the street. And then here's Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son. He does the same thing. And they take him to the police station, mugshot, bail, everything. His picture's on all the newspapers across the country. What's the difference? You see? So the closer you are to God, the more you are his servant, the more impact your fruit has in the world and also your errors. That's why I always tell the elders, I'm reminding them whenever we bring something new on, I says, now the punishment if you mess up is twice as much as if you weren't an elder. But the blessings, the rewards are twice as great because you are. That's just the way it is. We have to count cost. So, verse 11, an angel of Adonai said to her, behold, you will conceive, you have birth to a son, you shall name him Ishmael. For Adonai has heard your affliction, your anah, and he shall be a wild donkey of a man. Let's look at this. Ishmael means God will hear. You want God to hear everything? There's some things in my life I want God to hear. Other things I don't want him to hear. I wish nobody had heard them. I wish I hadn't said them. I wish I hadn't done them. But it just simply means, it's a neutral word. He'll hear. He'll hear. And Ishmael appears in the scriptures 56 times. But you know there's more than just one Ishmael in the Bible? Half of those times, 28 times, is referring to this Ishmael in Genesis here, the son of Abram and Hagar. The other 28 times is referring to Jewish men, mostly in the book of Jeremiah. Completely different ones, but the same name. Half the times it's this Ishmael, half the time it's these other Jewish men, especially the one in Jeremiah chapter 40, 41. So that's just something you can kind of search out on your own. But then it tells us about Ishmael's character. It says he'll be a wild donkey man. Para is the word for wild donkey. Adam is the word for man, like a word named Adam. Now, in Hebrew, you put the adjective after the noun. You don't say it's a big house, you say it's a house big. Or it's a red car, you say it's a car, red. Most languages work that way. Hebrew works the same way. So he's not saying he's a man who's like a wild donkey. He's saying he is a wild donkey who's manlike. And what are his activities? He says his hand will be against everyone. Everyone's hand will be against him. And he will dwell against his brothers. That word against his brothers can mean in opposition to them. It can also mean close to them. In this case, it means both. He'll be close to them geographically, and he'll be against them morally and theologically. Because you see, Ishmael's children are what we know of as Muslims. According to Islam, it was not Isaac that Abram took up on Mount Moriah to sacrifice. It was Ishmael he took up there. The Jews changed it. But it was Ishmael he took up to offer to God. And what do we read about radical Islamic terrorism? Their hands against everybody, even against other Muslims who they don't think are Muslim enough. Everybody's hands against them. Everybody's trying to figure out, what do we do with them? How do we resist them? How do we take control of this situation? And yet he dwells against his brothers. Who are his brothers? The Jewish people. They're cousins. Cousins are called brothers in the scriptures. He dwells right there in their midst. Muslims serve on the government in Israel. And yet they're blowing them up, attacking them, launching missiles at them, running buses over them. They're doing everything they can. They're right with them geographically and trying to wipe them out because they hate them. I want you to look at this wild donkey man for a moment too. Because remember, Ishmael, this is a spiritual picture as well of what happens when you operate out of fear and faithlessness. Just look physically at the letters. See how the last letter of Perah and the first letter of Adam are the same letter? And look at the middle letters. Don't they look similar? This one here is a resh, has an R sound. This is a dalet, has a duh sound. But they look almost the same, just has a little kink, right? A little sharp corner. And then the mem at the end of Adam is an enclosed letter, and the pei over here at the beginning of Perah is almost enclosed, just that little gap there in the lower left-hand corner. They reflect one another. God calls things by what their nature is, what their character is. And this Ishmael is a wild donkey. He's untamable. Now, a regular donkey is always a godly animal. It's the only animal that had to be redeemed by the blood of a lamb. But that's a different word. A para is a wild donkey, untamable donkey. It lives in the desert, does what it wants. But this wild donkey looks like a man, but his nature isn't. Fascinating. Way back here early in Genesis, God is looking down and say, Adam, Sarah, this is the result of your act of fear and faithlessness that you're launching into the world. I'm going to stop right there. You can finish up the end on your own. We've gone long enough. But this is one of those chapters that's just kind of strange and just like, wow, how could that happen? And how could God allow what happens here to continue to affect the world like it does? He's God. And he's using it. One of the things I heard a very wise rabbi say, got to talk to him. We were asking about Islam. And he lives in Israel. Lives in Jerusalem. And what are you doing? How do we take care of Islam? How do we get this under control? How do we fight it? He says, you don't fight it. All you do is you submit God. The more we submit ourselves to God, Islam just goes away. He says it's a force that God's brought in the world to rise up and attack when our faith in God, our love for God, and service to God diminish. So you don't fight the darkness, you just, let's become light again. And when we do, it just begins to recede and kind of go away. I thought that's a wise answer. Isn't that something? So anyways, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this amazing and wonderful short little chapter. I pray the lessons and the insights that have been shared here by so many would stay in our hearts and minds and affect us. And Lord, I pray most of all you give us hearts of gratitude, even when we're going through pain. Teach us to thank you for the ana you bring into our lives, because it has purpose. And as Tim shared, I pray, Father, that we'd keep our eyes on the goal. Look to the goal. Look to the outcome. And if we do, then like Yeshua, we can endure the cross. That we can despise the shame. We can laugh at it because, Father, it's got a purpose. And it's got a wonderful fruit, a wonderful outcome at the end. Help us to be that kind of people. Help us to learn from the mistakes of our father, Abraham, and mother, Sarah. And Lord, how gracious and good you are. You entered into a blood covenant with Abraham, knowing that he had flaws, knowing he had weaknesses. But you entered into it anyway. What a wonderful, loving, and kind God you are. Thank you for being so faithful when we're not. We can't help but praise you and thank you for how you've proven that to us through your Son, Yeshua, in whose name we pray. Amen.